From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conservative economist says President Bush is a pretend conservative who is using the right to pursue his own agenda. We'll talk with Bruce Bartlett, author of the new book Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. Bartlett worked in the Reagan White House and in the Treasury Department of George H.W. Bush. He's now a syndicated columnist. And Ken Tucker reviews the Arctic Monkeys' debut album. CD sales have been phenomenal, but Ken says you may be more interested in the new CD by another young British band called Clear Lake. He'll review their CD, too. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new book accusing President Bush of having seriously hurt the country has been written by a conservative economist. My guest, Bruce Bartlett, writes, quote, George Bush is widely considered to be one of the most politically conservative presidents in history. But those on the right have a different perspective, mostly discussed among themselves or in forums that fly below the major media's radar. They know that Bush has never really been one of them, the way Ronald Reagan was. Bush is more like Richard Nixon, a man who used the right to pursue his agenda, but never really was part of it. In short, he is an imposter, a pretend conservative, unquote. Bartlett's new book is called Imposter: How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. Bartlett worked in the Reagan White House and in the Treasury Department of the first President Bush. He writes a nationally syndicated column and is a former senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis. So do you think a lot of conservatives are, like you, now critical of the president?
Oh, absolutely. It's certainly not by any means a universally held view. But I think in terms of the conservative intelligentsia, shall we say, the sort of people who write for, say, National Review magazine, if you read their blog, you'll find echoes of the kinds of comments. In fact, many of them are in fact quoted in the book, where people have had, you know, deep misgivings about a lot of things George Bush has done since day one. And I think that one, for example, is this whole idea of big government conservatism or compassionate conservatism. These have always seemed to be a repudiation in some ways of what is the traditional conservative philosophy, which I think is was best articulated by Ronald Reagan, who I think is his views really represent the core of what the Republican Party is about, in the same way that Franklin D. Roosevelt's views, I think, still form the core of what the Democratic Party is about. And I think that that's why I believe that I say George Bush is an imposter and that he has betrayed the Reagan legacy.
Before your book was published, you showed a copy to the person who headed the think tank, the conservative think tank at which you were a senior fellow. It was the National Center for Policy Analysis. And after he read the advance copy of your book, you were dismissed from the think tank. The official reason was that you were expected to write a book about policy and that this seemed more personal, a more personal criticism of the president. Did you expect to get fired?
Oh, I think I knew I was going to be in trouble when I first decided to start writing the book, which was just about a year ago now, in February of 2005. And in fact, I toyed with the idea of trying to write the book anonymously for some time until I realized that stylistically and for other reasons that just didn't work. So I knew that I was on thin ice. But the suddenness and the brutality of their throwing me overboard did catch me a little bit by surprise. I had worked for these people for 10 years and was responsible for something like half of their press coverage. And I thought that they would want to at least stay on my good side and try to end our relationship a more amicably than they did. And so that surprised me, but asking me to leave was not really a surprise.
So although you say a lot of conservatives are disenchanted with President Bush, do you feel like you've broken rank by writing this book?
Oh, absolutely. I think the main criticism I've gotten from my conservative friends is not about the substance of what I said, but just that you shouldn't be saying these things publicly. It's okay for us to talk amongst ourselves about these sorts of things, but you're not supposed to give aid and comfort to the enemy, so to speak. But I think that that's a short-sighted attitude. I think those in the Republican Party need to have a debate about these matters before 2008, because we're moving into the time period in which We're going to be choosing both parties, our candidates for the next president, and thinking about the strategy and programs and policies those candidates are going to run on. And I think that we need to assess the Bush legacy and figure out, is this one we want to carry forward, or do we want to go in a different direction?
Was there a period when you felt you should hold your tongue or just have these kinds of debates behind closed doors with other fellow conservatives as opposed to a more public forum?
Well, I wouldn't have written this book if it were going to be published before the election. But once past the election in 2004, I didn't see any reason to hold back anymore. And nothing in this book is going to do anything to hurt George Bush's reelection prospects because he can't run for reelection. And so I think that now's the time to do this. If not now, then when?
You call the president an imposter and a pretend conservative. In what way do you think of him as an imposter?
Well, I think that he's really, as I said, betrayed the Reagan idea of we want small government. We don't want to expand government spending. I should say that the break for me personally was the Medicare drug benefit, which was enacted in November 2003. To me, this is the epitome of bad legislation. And all of the problems we're reading about in the paper almost daily, I think, were perfectly predictable. This is not the sort of thing, at least, that Republicans would be doing. And in fact, I don't think Democrats would do it either. I think that it's just really a bad program. It's going to cost trillions and trillions of dollars without doing much of anything to improve the health care of the elderly population. So that was really when I started to realize that this guy isn't one of us, and I started also rethinking the Clinton legacy. I thought he was a pretty bad president at the time he was in office. But looking back from today, I see that at least on things like the budget, he was a much, much better president than George Bush has been.
Did you ever think you'd hear yourself saying that?
Well, I've said it before, but I guess it's worth saying again. I one of the things I don't understand about the Democratic Party is why they trashed really their own legacy, in the sense that they had a very successful president for the only two-term president the Democrats have had since FDR, who ran on a fairly moderate conservative program of running budget surpluses and things of that sort. And yet neither Al Gore nor John Kerry really ran on that platform, and they did things very differently. And I think that has hurt the Democratic Party, and one thing I tried to do in this book is try to point a direction for a way in which I think a Democrat could respond to the things that Bush has done by trying to get back to what I think, at least, was good about what Bill Clinton did in office.
So, let's get back to the prescription drug plan. And you wonder in the book, is this the worst legislation ever passed? So, you know, you clearly don't like this drug plan at all. How much of it is because you don't like the idea at all that there should be any kind of federal funding for prescription drugs for older people? And how much of it is how the bill was written?
I mean, if it was up to me, I wouldn't have done the legislation at all, but I do understand that we live in a democracy and my vote isn't the one that counts. But I do think that a much more targeted bill that was not nearly so large and costly could have been enacted to deal with reasonable concerns about the costs of drugs for elderly people who can't afford them. But the legislation, one of the problems with the legislation is that it covers everybody. Millionaires get their drugs paid for as well as poor people. It applies even to people who already had perfectly good drug coverage from private insurance or from pension plans and things of that sort. So the legislation was vastly larger than necessary to meet any kind of reasonable concerns about the needs to provide drug benefits. And I don't understand to this day why that was done. And I do believe that as time goes by, the new money that is being paid out for drugs is just going to drive up the prices of drugs. So that at the end of the day, they're not going to be any more affordable than they are now. The subsidy will just cover the additional increase in cost that is going to occur. And I'm very fearful that down the road, when people finally realize that this program is more expensive than we can afford, the government is inevitably going to impose price controls on drugs, because that's what every other country in the world just about has done. And I'm fearful about what impact that will have on the creation and development of new drugs. And so I think for a variety of reasons, this was just a very ill-conceived legislation.
My guest is conservative economist Bruce Bartlett. His new book about President Bush is called Imposter. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Bartlett. His new book is called Imposter: How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. Bruce Bartlett is a conservative political columnist. He worked in the Reagan White House. He wrote the bestseller Reaganomics. He also worked in the Treasury Department under the first President Bush. Now, let me read another criticism that you write about President Bush. You say he's simply a partisan Republican, anxious to improve the fortunes of his party, to be sure, but he's perfectly willing to jettison conservative principles at a moment's notice to achieve that goal. So are you saying that you think the president's larger goal is to keep the Republican Party in power, and he'll forego larger conservative principles and philosophies in order to do that? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think there's any question that that is the case. I think, you know, if you sort of view the Republican Party from the point of view of the left, it's assumed that all Republicans are conservatives, but that's not really the case. There's a lot of people in both parties that are members of that party for reasons that really are not at all philosophical. It's, you know, one of my professors in college likened party loyalty to support for a sports team. I mean, I live in Washington, so I'm a Redskins fan. You live in Philadelphia, so maybe you're an Eagles fan. It's really not any deeper than that. It's just, this is my team, and I'm supporting them. And so there's an awful lot of people in the Republican Party who are not conservatives, and I think George Bush is one of them. But he does want to help his team, and he's done a lot to try to help the Republican Party stay in power in Congress and elect Republicans around the country. But that's not the same thing as supporting a conservative agenda, because sometimes you have to sacrifice your team to do what's right, and Bush is never willing to do that. I think the most telling thing about his whole presidency, really, that I find most appalling, is the fact that here, more than 5 years into his administration, he's yet to veto a single solitary piece of legislation. And I just, I still can't quite comprehend that. You have to go back to John Quincy Adams to find a president who served an entire 4-year term without vetoing a single bill. And that of course, was in the 1820s.
Well, you could argue, what's to veto? I mean, he has a Republican House and Republican Senate.
Well, there we all know that there's just a vast amount of pork barrel spending that has been enacted over the last 6 years. People on my side and even liberals complain about this all the time, but Bush does nothing about it. He threatens to veto things all the time, but he never does. And so the Congress has figured out that his threats are empty. And so they just load on the pork, no matter how egregious it is, no matter how obvious it is, and they simply don't care. It's the job of the president to look out for the national interest, which no individual member of Congress really can do, because they only represent individual states or individual districts, and they're going to do what's best for those states or districts, even if it conflicts with what is good for the country as a whole. And that's why the veto is extremely important. I think if he had vetoed just one bill back in 2001, it would have made his future veto threats more credible and probably saved us tens of billions of dollars of wasteful spending.
You say the president has never vetoed a bill. He's only threatened to. Well, right now he's really threatening to veto legislation. A company from the United Arab Emirates is purchasing a British firm that runs port operations in six American cities. The Bush administration has approved the deal, but many Republicans and Democrats in Congress are very opposed to the idea of an Arab country running American ports. The United Arab Emirates government hasn't been linked to terrorism, but people within the country have. Members of Congress are proposing a bill to stop the deal, and the president says he would veto any such bill. And in fact, Bill Frist says he would propose such legislation. What does this issue look like to you from your perspective as an economist?
Well, the main thing that I'm thinking as I read about this debate is that we have a huge foreign trade deficit. There's, you know, literally trillions of dollars circulating around outside the United States in the hands of foreigners whose appetite for American goods is not that great. So they have to find something useful to do with those dollars, and they have to be able to invest them in U.S. assets, dollar-denominated assets. And so if we send the signal to the world that for purely political reasons we're going to deny a legitimate foreign business, an opportunity to buy an American business, then I think this sends a dangerous signal to foreign investors that maybe those dollars they're holding aren't worth quite as much as they might think they are.
So you side with the Bush administration on this one. You think the deal should go
through? Not necessarily. I'm just saying I'm trying to look at it from their point of view.
I see.
Keep in mind that the organization that investigates and rules on the permissibility of these kinds of foreign investments is chaired by the Treasury Secretary. And that's not a coincidence. This is really a macroeconomic issue that is very much related to the value of the dollar on foreign exchange markets. And I have to believe that that is the primary consideration that is leading the administration to do something that might, on its face, seem ridiculous, both from a national security and from a political point of view.
But, you know, the president has also said that the United Arab Emirates is an ally in the war on terror, and if we deny them this opportunity, it's going to send them the wrong message. And I think the implication there is we don't want to alienate an ally in the war on terror. So that seems to be the concern that he's pushing right now.
Oh, they may believe that is the best argument for them to make publicly. I don't know. Or maybe they believe that is the best argument. All I know is that when the Treasury looks at these kinds of things, they look at it primarily from an economic point of view. And there are other agencies, of course, such as Defense and Homeland Security that get in on this. But keep in mind that this is a long process, and if the Treasury had thought there was a problem, they could have signaled this early on and avoided this issue coming to a head.
You're very concerned about the future of the Republican Party. And what does the Republican Party look like to you now on this issue? Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and House Speaker Dennis Hastert have asked the president to delay this takeover and to, you know, to reconsider the security risk that it might pose. I think it's very unusual for Hastert and Frist to be standing in opposition to the president.
Well, keep in mind that Bill Frist is an all but announced candidate for president in 2008, and he may quite rightly view this as an issue on which he can gain support at the president's expense. The interesting thing about this from a political point of view to me is that the one group of conservatives that have been most steadfast in their support of the president have been those who are primarily concerned about national security. And now he is really basically telling them that their concerns are not valid either. So I think he's just enlarged the universe of conservatives who feel, as I do, that Bush is not really very conservative.
So do you see this as a possible turning point for conservatives and for the Republican Party?
It could be. The same group of people who are deeply concerned about immigration are the ones who are mostly concerned about this port business, and that's an issue that is festering and coming to a head as well. So I think the president is in for a couple of weeks of really bad times from his own people. And I rather suspect that if legislation about this port stuff really does get going, I think it's quite possible it could have a veto-proof majority in both houses.
Bruce Bartlett is a syndicated columnist and the author of the new book, Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, conservative economist Bruce Bartlett offers more reasons why he thinks President Bush is a pretend conservative. And Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the British band The Arctic Monkeys. It's selling phenomenally well, but Ken says you may be more interested in another young British band whose record he'll also review. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bruce Bartlett, a conservative economist who says that President Bush is a pretend conservative who is using the right to pursue his own agenda. Bartlett is the author of the new book, Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. Bartlett worked in the Reagan White House and in the Treasury Department of George H.W. Bush. Bartlett criticizes several of President George W. Bush's policies for betraying conservative principles. What about the tax cuts? I mean, so much of the president's tenure in the White House has been about cutting taxes. And that's something that I would think you'd be applauding him for. As a conservative, you know.
Yeah. But you know, one of the things that former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill complained about is he said to Bush, and this is quoted in Ron Suskind's book, he said, look, tax cuts are fine, but they're not an economic policy. They're just one thing. And I think that they become a substitute for a broader economic policy that I still don't think we have. And I think that a lot more could have been done to enact or to fundamentally restructure the tax code in ways that would be much more positive for economic growth. The problem is that a lot of these tax cuts that were enacted are just the tax equivalent of pork barrel spending. That is, they do nothing except lose revenue without doing anything to improve the fairness or the ability of the tax code to encourage growth. And I think a lot of revenue was sacrificed for really nothing. And I think we could have made a lot more progress than we have.
Now, you say that some people like the tax cuts because it's part of the starve the beast philosophy, that philosophy being that, you know, government is a big beast, and if you starve it, it can't spend money on a lot of social programs that it shouldn't be spending money on in the first place. So that's the starve the beast philosophy. And you're saying the starve the beast philosophy doesn't work anymore. Why not?
Well, that's another concern I have about the tax cuts. A lot of conservatives rationalize that any tax cut is worth supporting because it takes the money away from the government. Ronald Reagan put it in a speech one time. He said it's like taking away the allowance of an overindulgent child. That's the way to get them to control their spending. You take away their allowance. But the premise of that theory is that the deficit would become a problem that politicians would eventually have to deal with, and that this would cause them to at least restrain the growth of spending and hopefully cut spending. But we've seen no evidence of that, none whatsoever. Government spending has skyrocketed in this administration, and the deficit has gone up too, and yet nobody really seems to care.
Has the philosophy of deficits changed among conservatives?
Well, certainly the economics seems to have changed. I mean, economic theory tells us that interest rates should have risen quite a bit from the deficits. And yet interest rates continued to fall even as the deficits increased. So clearly there's something going on in the economy that has changed the way deficits affected the economy, say, in the 1980s, when we had budget deal after budget deal trying to get control of the deficit. Now nobody really seems to have any interest in it. Nobody in financial markets is complaining. The Federal Reserve isn't really complaining. We just seem to be in some kind of calm before the storm, and I do think a storm is going to hit one of these days, and the deficit will become a problem again. But the longer we go before that happens, the more likely, I'm afraid, that it will end in some kind of crisis.
Well, let me just ask you a little bit more about why you think many conservatives now are willing to overlook the huge deficit that America faces.
Well, that's a puzzling thing, too, because historically, conservatives have viewed the deficit not merely as an economic problem, but as a moral problem. That it's just wrong as a matter of principle to impose costs on future generations so that the current generation can indulge itself in tax cuts or spending or whatever led to the creation of the deficit. And you almost never hear anybody talk about that anymore. I keep asking, you know, where's Ross Perot when we need him? I don't know.
You're not just critical of the president's policies. You're critical of his management style. You describe him as being obsessed with secrecy. Give us what you think is the best example of that.
Well, it was just reported in the newspapers this week, for example, that the president is reimposing secrecy on previously declassified documents. And I do think that he has a style that is not open either to the American people or to his own staff about how he comes to the decisions that he makes. Historically, there's been a policy development process that goes on in the administration that is fairly transparent, that is just short-circuited in this administration. The president makes decisions without apparently any analysis or study or consultation, and just imposes them by fiat upon his staff. And he certainly has the right to do that and the power, but I think it's very unwise because mistakes get made. You need to have a transparent process where things can be debated in public, because you can't know everything about a policy before it's implemented. And you need to bring as many points of view and as many facts together as you possibly can. And one of the things that bothers me about the president is his attitude towards the media. This may sound surprising coming from a conservative, but I do think that there's a problem when you have an administration that has no leaks. I think there's things that that need to leak out sometimes, but the president is very, very adamant that decisions about a lot of things not be discussed publicly before they're made, by which time it's too late to influence them. And I think this just leads to mistakes, many of which we've already talked about in terms of Iraq and Katrina and any number of things that we're well aware of.
You describe the president as pro-business as opposed to free market. What's the distinction that you're making?
Well, in many cases there is no distinction, but in many cases there is. I think that a lot of government regulation and subsidies and things of that sort are done to help individual industries or individual companies that are totally inconsistent with a free market conservative point of view. And I think that this is a problem for this White House, that they cannot make that distinction. For example, one of the things that I think one of the worst mistakes President Bush made was to impose tariffs on imported steel. The only thing that this did was increase the profits of the domestic steel manufacturers. I don't really understand why that is an appropriate public policy. He's greatly increased subsidies to the agriculture sector, and it's been all free market economists think that we ought to have a free market in agricultural goods just as in other goods. And this was really a very bad mistake, because I think it had a lot to do with why the agenda for the Doha round of trade negotiations has basically gone nowhere. And for this reason, I think that one could argue that at the end of the day, Bush will have possibly the worst record on trade of any president since Herbert Hoover, who is rightly condemned for having enacted the Smoot-Hawley tariff that brought on, or at least contributed to, the Great Depression.
Where does the war in Iraq fit into your thinking about President Bush?
Well, I didn't really get into that in the book because I'm an economist and I tried to stick to writing about the things that I know about. But certainly I think it's reasonable to conclude that the war in Iraq has more in common with Woodrow Wilson's idea that we have a responsibility to make the world safer democracy than it does with the historical conservative philosophy about foreign affairs, which is that our job is to defend the homeland. Our job is not to invade foreign countries unless we're absolutely compelled to by necessity. And I think a lot of conservatives have had deep misgivings about the war since day one, even before the many problems that we've seen there have become apparent.
Since you are an economist, let's look at this a moment on a purely economic level. What do you think of the idea of continuing to cut taxes in a time when we're fighting a hugely expensive war in Iraq, not to mention trying to bolster ourselves at home against attack from terrorists?
Well, I think it's a bad idea to increase spending, whether it's for a war in Iraq or for pork barrel programs or Medicare drug benefits, at a time when you're cutting taxes. I think the whole idea, at least on my side of the political spectrum, has always been that we want to take away the allowance and use tax cuts to reduce the size of government. And what we've done instead is we've cut taxes and increased the size of government. So it's those two things together that I think is really the problem. And I think that the Iraq operation has had a lot of problems with it that have made the war more expensive than was anticipated. And these costs are going to continue for a long time to come, and are a pretty good reason to be concerned about what's going on there.
My guest is conservative economist Bruce Bartlett. His new book about President Bush is called Imposter. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Bartlett. He's the author of the new book, Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. Let me quote something that the conservative columnist David Brooks wrote in his column in the New York Times back in October of 2005. He wrote about you, "Bartlett emerges as the most articulate spokesman for the view, which I hear all the time now, that Bush has betrayed conservatism. He's monarchized it and saved it. Despite all the mistakes that have been made, it is nonetheless true that Bush has ennobled and saved American conservatism." What are some of the things you think the president has done right? What are some of the things you think the president has done to further the conservative movement in America?
Well, I think one area where most conservatives would say he's really done the right thing is with his judicial appointments. The Harriet Myers detour aside, I don't know any conservative who doesn't think that Justice Roberts and Justice Alito are really excellent appointments to the court. I think that most conservatives believe that the court has been really out of control for a generation, and that we need to get back to a more strict construction view of the Constitution. And I think that would be one area where people might reasonably say, if the government has to waste some money on pork barrel to get us these kinds of justices, that's a good trade-off. There are also many conservatives who strongly believe that the Bush's policies with respect to the war on terror and the war in Iraq are correct. I'm not so sure about that, but it is a reasonable point of view that a good many conservatives agree with. And they would again say, well, this problem is so big and so terrible that it trumps all other concerns. And if we have to, again, do some things on the domestic side that we would otherwise not want to do, well, then so be it. You have to look at the big picture. So I think in general, in terms of people who are religious conservatives who are mainly concerned about social issues, I think he's probably done a pretty good job for them. It's the more libertarian wing of the party, the more movement conservative type people that really have the problems with Bush, and I do think that they are starting to speak out more and more as time goes by. And part of the reason I wrote this book was simply to start a debate and to have some discussion about these matters.
Ron Suskind wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine about the president and faith-based politics. This was in October of 2004. And he spoke to you for the article, And Susskind wrote, Bruce Bartlett told me that, quote, if Bush wins, there will be a civil war in the Republican Party starting on November 3rd. And you told Susskind that it would be a battle between modernists and fundamentalists, pragmatists and true believers, reason and religion. Well, it's way past November 3rd, 2004. Do you think this battle within the Republican Party, the Civil War, actually ever happened?
Well, what I thought was going to happen is that the race for 2008 would get started fairly quickly. See, we have not an unprecedented situation, but certainly an unusual one in that we have a two-term president whose vice president is not in a position to succeed him. Normally speaking, that's what we had. We had Al Gore in 2000 and George H.W. Bush in 1988, etc. So because Dick Cheney has no, you know, further ambitions and is very unlikely to run, we have an unusual opening for somebody new to represent the Republican Party in 2008. And I thought people who feel like I do, who have had some deep misgivings about Bush all along, but held them in check because for fear of aiding the Democrats, would now feel free to speak out. And I thought there would be a lot more people saying the kinds of things I'm saying. And why that isn't the case is frankly a mystery to me, because the way I see it, there's a big constituency, maybe not a majority of the Republican Party, but certainly a big chunk of it, that really adheres to a traditional conservative message as best articulated by Ronald Reagan, and they're looking for a leader, and they don't have one. And I think somebody on my side would have a good shot at getting the Republican nomination in 2008 by, in effect, running as Ronald Reagan's heir, trying to articulate the same message that he put forward. And frankly, it does surprise me that nobody has figured this out yet.
Has being as outspoken as you are now about your criticisms of President Bush led you to have any new friends or new colleagues? Do you know what I mean? Are you talking to people who you didn't talk to before, or
really? Yeah. I've always maintained a dialogue with people on the left, and there are a number of bloggers and who are pretty well to the left of me that I carry on a discussion with. Because ultimately, I just want the right policies. I think that conservative policies are better. But as I point out in the book, I think Bill Clinton had some pretty good policies that are worth redoing. And I think that also that the parties operate best when there's competition between them. When one party is totally dominant, I think that's bad, whether it's my party or the Democratic Party, because it allows each side to get away with things they shouldn't get away with. And so I honestly think that as a Republican, we'd have a better country if we had a stronger Democratic Party.
You argue bring back gridlock.
I do think that many of the good things that happened on Clinton's watch came about only because the Republicans controlled Congress, and that's fine. And I think that if you look back historically, we've had gridlock in the sense of one party in the White House and another party in Congress. And those were pretty good times in the 50s and other times. And I think there's a lot to be said for the idea that neither party can be entirely trusted to have full control of government. And the other party needs to have veto power over so as to feel that they're part of the process and not just have policies rammed down their throats. So I do like the idea of gridlock, no question about that.
Well, Bruce Bartlett, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bruce Bartlett is a syndicated columnist and author of the new book, Imposter. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the debut CD by the Arctic Monkeys. It's incredibly popular, but Ken prefers a new CD by another young British band. He'll review that one, too. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The British music press is hailing a new band, the Arctic Monkeys, as being as big as the Beatles, or at least as big as Oasis. The first week release of the band's debut album, called Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, sold over 118,000 copies, more than the rest of the top 20 albums combined. Rock critic Ken Tucker explores the Arctic Monkeys phenomenon and suggests you might be more interested in another young British band, Clear Lake, whose third album, Amber, has also just been released here. Here's the Arctic Monkeys.
The Arctic Monkeys represent one new business model for rock bands. They posted their demos on the internet, on teen-oriented sites like MySpace.com, and generated buzz with their raw little tales of romance on the rebound and trying to get past bouncers into crowded music clubs. Signed as a word-of-mouth or word-of-cyberspace phenomenon, the quartet finds itself at the center of the industry right now. It probably helps that lead singer Alex Turner has a scratchy throat and a tendency to shout the lyrics as much as sing them. He's like The Clash's Joe Strummer, or The Stones' Keith Richards, but green around the gills. He makes his youth and his innately sour line readings work for him. Too bad the band's umpteenth variation on British reggae and punk rock guitar chords don't add up to very compelling rhythms.
Stop making the eyes at me, I'll stop making the eyes at you. What it is that surprises me is that I don't really want you to. When your shoulders are frozen, over you're an explosion. Your name isn't real, but I don't care for sand and light.
The Arctic Monkeys arrive in America as young stars, but they don't export very well. You can imagine why their thick northern accents, they hail from Sheffield, and talk of Larry girls and policemen with truncheons go over well with the home crowd, and will do the same with Anglophile cultists here. But a mass American audience? I doubt it. The stodgy, dodgy music doesn't deserve it. The Arctic Monkeys lack what another British quartet, sharing the same producer, has in abundance. Melodies with hooks, lyrics with some emotional resonance. This is Clear Lake.
I say what I want, 'cause nobody's listening. I say what I want, I tell you another thing. You don't understand, I know.
Clear Lake's lead singer Jason Pegg sings with a bursting clarity that matches the crisp imagery and sentiments in his band's music. Clear Lake's new third album, called Amber, captures certain scenes with spine-tingling precision. Listen to them revitalize the old, we stayed up all night talking romantic scenario in this song, Getting Light Outside.
Even better how we stay the same.
At one point, the chorus unfolds with the couplet, "I feel fine in your company, even when we sit silently." And it's such a simple, direct statement of affection, your heart breaks and mends itself at the same time. Even the added string section doesn't sound sappy. There's no self-pity in the words. There's just an intense interest in the object of the singer's affection. Clearlake, four blokes from Brighton, are working the same territory as the Arctic Monkeys, longing, pleasure taken in small moments. But they do it with so much more delicacy and idealism that, even with three albums under their belts and a distinct lack of hype going for them, they make monkeys out of their chilly Arctic colleagues.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed new albums by the Arctic Monkeys and Clear Lake. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from Diane Wolfe of New York and Washington, D.C., in great appreciation of NPR's mission to create a more informed public. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Newsweek's Middle East editor Christopher Dickey about the new Hamas-led Palestinian government, Iran's nuclear program, and the Muslim protests against cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.